Live from Edmondville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the best podcast about science that you will ever hear. My name is Chris Geiser, and with me is Michael Crosser. And today's episode is entitled Biogeography, Why Things Are Where They Are.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah, I didn't get on the big board today.
No, and I thought you were going to say colon.
I was going to say biogeography, colon, why things are where they are.
Because you love those colons.
Because I love those colons, and I forgot. And if you want, you can edit that and put it in where it was supposed to be.
I think it's funnier that we're breaking it down now.
Yeah, do you? Okay. And when I was saying that, I was thinking, well, maybe the listeners are going to think why things are in your colon. And I don't, that's not what it's, we're talking about. We're not talking about your colon. Nope, we're talking about the punctuation mark here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in our last episode, we were talking about tectonic plates and how they cause volcanoes and that sort of thing. And we started getting off on this tangent about how we know just by looking at the flora and the fauna in different regions where how long ago they must have separated from each other. Anyway, we started getting into this and then we said, no, we need to talk about lava. Because that was the question from avid listener Kathleen. But we realized we should talk about this time around.
Yeah. And so that's an important piece. So the overarching kind of idea here is called biogeography. And the notion is that there are geographical reasons why flora and fauna appear where they are. Part of the answer, as you say, Mike, is plate tectonics. So a really good example of that would be, well, I had a little thing I wanted to say that I thought was kind of interesting. I was thinking about this notion of noticing the universe and asking yourself, why is that thing there and not over there? Why do you have large predators here and you don't have them here? Or how come you have this kind of tree here and a different kind of tree there? And plate tectonics is a piece of that. One of the best examples, I think, of this is, say, a large landmass like Asia. One would expect, I think, to have, at a given latitude, you'd expect to have the same kinds of organisms there throughout that entire landmass because presumably they can move around and things. And you find that.
And so you're saying latitude, like if you're at the equator, you would expect things that are just can only handle one temperature, basically.
Yes, right, sure. Or can operate within a range. But yeah, I think it's an important thing to say. And this is a really, really actually important part of biogeography is that, you know, longitude doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter whether you move east to west. But it matters a lot whether you move north or south, because temperature, precipitation, sunlight, all those things change dramatically as you move north or south.
Now, would you expect...
And of course, it's important to realize, and this is a really important thing and cool thing about biogeography, is that if you start at the equator and move north, and then walk back to the equator and walk south, you'll see the same thing.
That was what I was going to ask.
Yeah, that 20 degrees latitude north and 20 degrees latitude south is about the same.
Hmm.
Yeah. And in fact, so actually all of this, I should say, was, I don't know when it was first noticed, but it was first really described by both Wallace and Darwin, the two sort of co-discoverers of evolution, because they noticed this very thing. They traveled around and noticed that they, you know, as they moved east-west, things didn't change that much. I mean, species will change, but it's not like you're not going to see polar bears at the equator and you're not going to see birds of paradise, in Siberia.
Mm.
Those are two examples of organisms that are very specific to their latitude.
But so you wouldn't see like the same animals at say 45 degrees north and 45 degrees south.
Yeah, I think the question about sameness, and that's a good question, Mike. It's not really, and by same, I don't mean the exact same species. I mean the same kind of niche. So if there's a predator niche at one latitude, you'd expect that same niche to be filled at the same latitude in south.
Okay.
Just like there's wolves in North America or big cats in South America.
So you just gave an example of different latitudes.
Well, a better way of talking about latitude would be to say if one was to start, and this goes to this thing you and I have talked about before about how weather patterns work as well. So if you start in the northern temperate forest of, say, North America, you'll find conifers and you'll find wolves and things like that. And you'll find a certain group of organisms. And then you start moving south and then you get into what's called the Mediterranean climate. It's drier and you'll see olives and maybe some things that you wouldn't have seen farther north. Grapes, that's where grapes are rose. And then you move farther south and then you're in equator and you get a whole different sort of thing going on at the equator. And then you move south of that and you have that real dry zone again, So it's just exactly like Mediterranean, only just south of the equator. Right. And then you move down below that, and it gets to the southern temperate region. So you'll see conifers again, and you'll see exactly what you saw at the northern temperate region.
Okay. And as far as animals?
Animals follow the same pattern, yeah. But I couldn't give you an specific example.
Well, but you did.
Okay, good.
You talked about how there are wolves in the north, and they're meat-eating hunters, predators.
Yeah.
And then in the south, we don't have wolves, but there are big cats.
Yeah.
And so there's that's serving that niche, you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
That sure, they're totally different species, but they're serving the same function.
But back to your plate tectonics, for example, then you'd expect the whole Eurasian continent. And, of course, what you'd find is that's mostly what you see, with some striking differences. And one striking difference is India has a very different flora and fauna than the rest of Eurasia. And that's because that India, in fact, is its own, and we talked about this last week, in fact, is its own plate, which broke off many, many years ago from Pangaea and sort of rafted across the oceans and now is moving up into the south part of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And so the flora and fauna in India are not like the rest of Asia. They're like more like South America or more like Africa, actually. So that's a really interesting thing. And you mentioned this last week. You said, well, the fossils on the eastern side of South America will be like the fossils on the western side of Africa, also noticed by Darwin.
Yeah.
And that's, again, for the same reason, that those fossils come from a time when those two land masses were joined.
Hmm. How are the animals in India so different from, say, Asia?
I can't, because I can't think of one. But I can give you a little story that maybe you can weave in, which is, why are there no marsupials anywhere but Australia?
Okay.
And that's this reason, because marsupials actually arose back when it was Pangaea in South America. It wasn't South America then, it was Pangaea. But that landmass, that's where marsupial mammals, so these are all mammals, that is mammals, they have mammary glands, they nurse their young. That's what a mammal means.
And they have pouches.
Well, that's what a mammal means. If that happens inside a pouch, you call it a marsupial.
Okay.
If it doesn't happen inside of a pouch, then it's a placental mammal.
Okay.
And those two groups coexisted for a while. But then as the Australian plate moved across the ocean to where its now current location, took all the marsupials with it. And there were still some marsupials living in South America, but most of them, for reasons that we don't know, died out there. So the only place that marsupials still exist then is therefore in Australia.
Hmm.
In fact, people will say, I wonder why there are marsupials in North America, because there is. There's a marsupial possum. Possums are marsupials.
Okay.
And the answer is, they walked to North America. They didn't arise here. They arose in South America. And that's where you find marsupial fossils, just like you'll find them, right? So that's how we know that's where the Australian marsupials came from, because we can see marsupial fossils in South America. So the possums didn't arise in North America. They arose in South America, and they walked once. Well, so again, this whole plate tectonics thing comes into play in many, many ways, like we talked about last week. For many years, North and South America were not joined. In fact, what we would call North America was joined to Eurasia via what we now call the Bering Land Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way to get to South America because they were separated. But then an isthmus rose through plate tectonics, rose between North and South America. And once that happened, we were connected. And that's the bridge that the possums walked across to come north. That's why we have them in North America.
Oh, so you're saying like modern day Panama and Costa Rica and all that?
Yeah, Central America. Yeah.
Did not exist.
Yeah, for a long time. That's actually fairly recent. In fact, we have another example of biogeography is you can look on either side of the isthmus between North and South America, what we'd call Central America. And there's many species, a very famous study in shrimps where you'll find shrimp families that clearly were all one family at one point and now have diverged slightly because they got trapped on either side of the isthmus.
Hmm.
So you can see here.
Oh, so you're saying there was water between.
Yeah, it was separated.
Yeah, and now that they are separated from each other, the Pacific Ocean shrimp are different from the Gulf Coast shrimp.
Yeah, exactly, Mike. But the difference is what's interesting about the difference, right, is that there are pairs that are really closely related, as if they were at one time one family and they've only diverged a little bit because that's a pretty recent event.
Mm.
In fact, that's the same thing as with humans, of course, because that's how humans got to South America. They walked. And they walked first across the Bering Land Bridge and then all the way down through North America and then across the isthmus and then into all the way into South America.
Hmm.
So this is another important piece of biogeography, is that ocean levels, that the distribution of organisms tells us a lot about what the Earth was like at a certain point in time. Mm. So what Wallace, in fact, discovered was in Indonesia, there's this place, it's called the Wallace Line, where Bali is on one side, and on the other side is another island whose name I can't remember. They're maybe 40 miles apart, 50 miles apart, not very far. And he noticed that when he went from one to the other, and they're sort of in the same latitude, when he went from one to the other, the flora and fauna completely changed. Okay. In fact, it was very much like everything from Bali westward was the same, and everything from the other island, whose name I can't remember, and sort of eastward and southward was more like Australia. And he realized that was because this channel is really deep, and at one point, everything westward was one continuous landmass. And so that's where folks stopped walking. Hmm. And by folks, I mean animals now, not just humans, and that's where they stop. And so you see these big differences in, say, animals and plants. So in other words, you could go from Bali long ways westward, and you'd see the same exact animals. But suddenly, just 40 miles away, the animals are all different because they couldn't get across. Mm-hmm. They couldn't walk. So even when the ocean levels were lower, they couldn't walk across. So that's where it stopped. But on the other hand, when the ocean levels were lower, Australia and some of the areas north of there, what we now would call islands, were one continuous landmass.
Okay. And so some of the islands off of Australia still have basically the same animals as
Australia. Like, for example...
Well, but so they should be slightly different, right? That... I don't know. Yeah, let's say a kangaroo or something.
No, well, so good. So that's when I say different, in all these cases, I'm saying not identical, but you can tell that they're closely related versus really, really far related. That's the way to think about it.
Okay.
So the whole marsupial thing, it's amazing that the marsupials are only, that they didn't spread. Why didn't they spread into, you know, northward from Australia? Because they couldn't.
So there are marsupials on these islands.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
but not 40 miles away from that one spot.
Right.
Okay.
Now, there's another layer that you got to think about, which is human intervention, of course. So, for example, you could say, well, there should be a marsupial predator because at that latitude, there would be some sort of meat-eating predator. And in fact, there was. There was a marsupial wolf called a thylacine, which was hunted to extinction. Hmm. And by the same token, you can say, oh, well, what about dingoes? But dingoes are actually just dogs, which is really kind of fascinating. Dingoes are, you know, like dingo ate your baby.
Yep.
Dingoes actually are the descendants of escaped dogs from the Polynesians who had colonized Australia.
Hmm.
Not wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So.
And the other weird thing, there's a couple other really fascinating things about this biogeography question, which is, and this is particularly on islands, where a really important piece of why organisms look the way they do is movement. If you think of it in human terms, you can think of trade. I mean, there's a lot of trade from, the Silk Road is from Asia to Europe. So there's trade all the way across there. Same thing with animals moving all the way across there. But they can't move north and south very well because they get out of their comfort zone, essentially. Same with plants. Plants at the equator, they don't care about day length because the day lengths never change. They don't particularly care about adaptations that help them save water because there's usually a lot of water at the equator.
Okay.
But you get very far north of the equator and you get into one of these dry areas and so everything just changes.
Mm-hmm.
And if the plants change, then the animals change. So, but on an island, nobody's moving.
And so that's kind of a cool thing that plants are changing, the animals have to change. But the way you're thinking about it is that they're each serving a particular niche. Right. So,
well, sure. Yeah.
So, for instance, there are cacti in North America in the desert regions. And I don't think there are cacti in the south, but there's something else that conserves water very efficiently.
That's a really interesting question. Are cacti, as a plant person, should know this, are they only New World? They certainly are in Central America, cacti. Basically, is a good example of distribution. Once you get, if you're in Mexico, for example, and you're moving south toward the Yucatan, about 20 degrees latitude, 29, I guess, whatever the tropic is over there, and the cacti go away because the water increases.
Sure.
And so that's a really good example of where that border is. This is where you start getting out of the high precipitation zone. So that's where that would stop. And then presumably, as you say, at 20 to 29 degrees south, you're definitely going to start that again. And if it's a cacti, I don't know. But you're right. It's going to go into a desert kind of habitat.
All right.
And it'll stay that way. In fact, it does stay that way until you get very, very far south. And then it starts changing into that southern temperate region. But I was going to say about islands. So because there isn't really movement on islands and animals and plants get trapped there, that's mm-hmm. where you see really bizarre things. Because the way evolution works is, as you say, Mike, correctly, that organisms are filling a niche. But to become a species, to become isolated, there has to be an event that allows that group to no longer interbreed with another group. And as long as all organisms within a group are able to access each other, then there's not any isolation, and so then speciation doesn't happen as much. Or if it does happen, it's mitigated by a more complex set of factors. Whereas on an island, it's such a simple and limited kind of ecosystem often that you get very unusual things. So on an island is the reason why you find, say, the best example is maybe Komodo dragons. You only find them on a couple islands in Indonesia because everywhere else, if they had gotten that big, they would have been preyed on by somebody else. Mm. Or something would have kept them from getting that big. Maybe they wouldn't have had as ready of a food source or something. But there's various kinds of animals that are living on this island that are just enough to keep this Komodo dragon population going. There's going to be intense competition between those Komodo dragons. And in fact, that intense competition is what made them the lizards so big in the first place. Because there's not a lot of lizards. There's not a lot of things. They're just the lizards. And so they're basically only fighting with themselves for this food source. Because there are no other predators competing with them. Because no other predators got to the island.
So you're saying that if a species is competing only with itself, it tends to get bigger?
I'm not sure I could say that was as a general rule, but it's what happened here.
Okay.
It depends. It's more complicated than that. But that's exactly what happened here. And lizards are really cool because they can live for long periods of time without food because of the way their metabolism works. And so, that's where you'll find the biggest lizards. But the Galapagos is the only place you'll find marine lizards, reptiles. And by marine, we don't mean... Well, what we mean is they actually make their living not as predators of other animals, but of algae. So that's what marine iguanas live on. They don't dive down and eat fish. They dive down and they graze on algae on rocks. Hmm. And they can stay underwater for a long time, like a turtle can. So reptiles can do this. Turtles are reptiles. But most reptiles don't. Certainly not most lizards don't. And that's another example of a very strange adaptation that works there and probably wouldn't work really anywhere else. Again, they don't have any other food source, nor do they have competitors for that niche. So it's always about niche, right? Hmm. That's what ecology is really all about. It's always about how you're going to make a sustainable living.
Hmm.
Yeah, marine iguanas are fascinating because you should ask, how did they get there? Another thing noticed by Wallace and Darwin was that you can look at, a tropical island. A good example is the Galapagos, in fact. And you could look at a tropical islands all the way around there at that latitude, and you would say to yourself, they should all be the same because they're all at the same latitude.
Okay.
One of the things that you find, you look at the islands and you find out they don't look the same. They're actually quite different from island to island. And then you could say, well, okay, why is that? Well, it depends on things like weather. So, for example, the Galapagos is not like other islands in that the way the currents work, it's actually quite deserty. It's not lush and green because of the way the currents work there. So that's a big difference. But then you think, okay, I understand why there's this sort of grouping of organisms that's different from, say, a nice tropical island, but they're still so unique. And if I look at them, what are they most similar like? They're most similar to the nearest landmass. So the flora and fauna in the Galapagos is all derived from Ecuador.
And so that makes sense that some seeds may blow off the trees in Ecuador and make their way over to the island.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's how plants got there.
Okay.
Birds flew or blown off course is more likely. And then what you see, that the finches are clearly derived from mainland South American finches, but they are all unique to the Galapagos. None of the finches that are there actually exist on the mainland.
Okay.
So, in other words, some ancestral finch got blown over to the Galapagos, and then the finches radiated, is the term, into all these different niches that exist. So there are finches that eat cactus seeds. There are finches that eat all different kinds of seeds, and they're basically their beak size. They have small beak finches and big beak finches and really big finches, none of which exist anywhere else, and they all live on specific seed types in the Galapagos.
Hmm.
There's a vampire finch, which actually eats animals, or actually sucks the blood of animals. There are all kinds of these finches. And the reason why is because their only competition is trying to find a niche that nobody else is in. And since they're the only finches there, they expand into the niche that somebody else on the mainland would have already filled.
So you're saying that on the mainland, there would be something that would suck the blood of something else.
Yeah, or a better example would be there's a finch on the Galapagos that's got a really big beak. Maybe that finch never occurs on the mainland because the big seed-eating bird niche is already taken by a different species entirely.
Okay.
Just like the grazing of algae niche is probably taken by some other organism from the mainland. So the marine iguana said, that's a good food source. I'll just eat that.
It's kind of tasty.
Yeah. Right? So biogeography in general is the thing I first told you about. But the island biogeography is like this, the same thing, but it's really tweaked up because of these weird lack of competition kind of things. Does that make sense, Mike, the way I'm saying
and
that?
And that they go off into weird... So when you say Galapagos, I think of turtles, actually.
That's a really good example. And by turtles, you actually mean tortoises. And and so one of the things that you find on the Galapagos is giant tortoises. And they, and giant tortoises are a really good example of something that only exists on islands. The other place that giant tortoises exist are on Mauritius and a few islands off the coast of Africa. But they only exist on islands because of a lack of predators. I guess, because they could get to this big size. I mean, usually the way you're going to live, I suppose, if you're a turtle or a tortoise, is kind of by hiding and by being small. And giant tortoises are like obvious prey, but they don't have anybody to eat them. Until humans came, of course. That's why there are no giant tortoises anymore, because humans came and ate them. But, you know, humans have boats. Until that happened, that's the thing, right? Is that certainly a finch wouldn't start out in Ecuador and go, you know, it's not really working for me here. I'm going to fly to that. I'm just going to fly out across the ocean and maybe I'll get to an island. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost certainly they were just blown off course and then landed there and ended up.
And are these finches, are they flightless?
No, they aren't flightless. But flightless birds is another good example of that, because other birds blown off course have landed on islands around the globe and, not finding any predators, lost their ability to fly. Because presumably the logic would be that's a huge amount of energy. And the two main reasons for flying, of course, are to escape a predator or to forage. And if you find yourself on an island with lots of bugs to eat that are on the ground, then you don't need to fly for it. Uh-huh. And if you don't have a predator, you don't have to fly for that either. I mean, a good example of this is chickens, right? I mean, you know, there are lots of chickens. I mean, they fly, but they don't really want to fly. Because they're only flying to get away from things. What they really want to do is walk around the ground and eat seeds and stuff.
Oh, sure.
So they're essentially flightless, right? They still only retain any ability to fly, so they can fly up in a tree and roost and get away from a ground predator or something. Mm-hmm. But if there is no ground predator, there would be no reason to even do that.
That makes sense.
So, for example, one of the things that Wallace found all these birds, and they're like, well, why are they all flightless? And then they sort of intuited this, and then they noticed that, in fact, flightless birds were pretty rare except on islands. And then what they mostly found, this is really big on Madagascar, really big on Mauritius, they found these gigantic flightless birds, like these elephant birds and the dodo and all these birds that were really big. And in fact, all they find is the remnants of them, because Polynesians had come before them and eaten them.
Yeah, so humans moving in someplace seem to really...
Oh, it's really bad. Dodos, for example. The reason why dodos were called dodos is because people thought they were stupid because they wouldn't move or get out of the way. But, of course, they had no reason to move or get out of the way. They had never seen a human before.
Yeah.
And they had no predators. It wasn't just a human. They were flightless and they were big and it didn't matter because they didn't have a predator. Their main deal was just foraging, and so they had no reason to flee a human. I mean, they would kill tortoises by just walking up to them and clubbing them, because nobody ever fled because they didn't have a predator. So they didn't know they needed to.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And tortoises, by the way, the reason which tortoises are so endangered now is because for many years they were poached by sailors. They were pretty much a staple. You'd go to an island and resupply by collecting a whole bunch of tortoises, turning them upside down in your hold of your ship. They can live for a long, long time that way, so the meat doesn't go bad, and then you just slaughter them as you needed them.
That is a perfect solution, I think.
Unless you're a tortoise.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it's so that whole idea of getting big or real small or really weird, that's an island thing. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Now, you had hinted last time something about how, for instance, Hawaii has a very different population because it just formed in the middle of nowhere, as opposed to the Galapagos, which have some relationship to Ecuador, and Madagascar, which has some relationship to Africa.
Yeah, that's true. And Hawaii is, of course, it's a good example of a tropical island. It's a good example of the flora which gets there, the seeds that blew there, or coconuts which floated there, or birds which got blown off course and then stayed there. So yeah, it's got a pretty unique ecosystem there. The nene, of course, it's their state bird, endangered. It's a flightless bird, only place on the earth that exists. Hmm. One of the things you see on islands that's fascinating is this thing called radiation. So just like the finches radiated, you have all these different kinds of finches on the Galapagos because that's the only bird that got there. I mean, there are other birds, but a lot of finches because they took up a lot of these different niches like we described. Hmm. In Hawaii, there's these things called silver swords, and that's a plant that you can find in various parts of the world, but they went bonkers in Hawaii because there's no competition. They diversified there, and so that's the only place they exist.
Cool.
Very often you'll find on islands, just like with the flightless birds story, it's the only place you'll find a given species of a bird or animal or plant. And that goes back to the very first topic. That would be because, of course, you'll see wolves in North America and wolves in Siberia. They walked across the Bering Land Bridge. They live in the exact same latitude. Siberian wolves are the wolves being used to repopulate North American wolf populations. And they've only diversified at all since the Bering Land Bridge went away and they became isolated. Before that, they were just walking back and forth, interbreeding, and it was basically one giant population.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Now they're slightly different from
now that. They're slightly different. Yeah, but they can still interbreed. It's what you'd call probably a subspecies. It depends on how you define species as a whole. That's a whole podcast in itself. But for my definition, as long as you can still interbreed, you'd call them the same species. And they can. So,
okay.
And that's a matter of time since separation. So, you know, presumably, if you waited long enough, you would have two different species of wolves that could no longer interbreed, and then you'd really call them different species. Kind of like the thylacine I told you about and a regular wolf, right? That wolf developed independently and certainly could never, it was a marsupial, so it could never interbreed with a regular placental wolf. But it was the only predator in Australia because what's going to support life is, do you have enough food? And it being an island, you know, big island, but still an island, there wasn't enough food just to support a lot of predators. So basically there was one predator. And what's controlling the thylacine population, of course, is the availability of food.
Yeah.
Oh, and you also could say, well, there should have been big predators at the same latitude in North America as there are in Africa. And there should have been big things to eat. And there were. But they've all been killed out. North America had enormous bison, mammoths, tigers, huge lions, giant bears, much bigger than currently exist in Africa. So it's a good example of you have to be able to look at the fossil record and the current record to be able to get a full picture. And so the fossil record tells us originally North America and Africa looked a lot more similar. North America and South America and Africa and South America looked a lot more similar. Hmm. But the New World looks a lot different than it used to, partly because the large predators and large animals in Africa sort of co-evolved with humans. But the ones in North America didn't.
Okay, sure.
So when humans walked over there, they were like the dodo. They were completely naive to the presence of man and were wiped out.
Hmm.
Well, the predators weren't wiped out. The mammals were wiped out, which meant that the predators didn't have anything to eat.
Right. Very cool.
Anyway, question, anything just leaps out? Let me want to know?
No.
Okay.
There we go.
All
right. This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rody Ortega wrote our theme music. Like us on Facebook and see what we're up to. Subscribe to the podcast. And while there, you should leave a rating and a comment. That'll help other people find our podcast later on. If you have an idea for a future episode, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Until next time, thanks for listening.